It is Wednesday, January 31st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, President Donald Trump calls for unity in his first State of the Union address. We get reaction.
What people are going to be paying attention to is what he does as president, not what he says in one speech.
The Palestinian Aid Agency faces the worst financial crisis in its history, and a new documentary explores the career of the late executive editor of The Washington Post, Ben Bradley. It's all ahead. U.S. President Donald Trump called for unity and touted what he sees as accomplishments on foreign policy and the economy during his first State of the Union address on Tuesday. During an 80-minute speech, Trump called for lawmakers to pass his proposal for overhauling the country's immigration system and revamping the country's infrastructure.
So let's begin tonight by recognizing that the state of our union is strong because our people are strong.
The speech lacked the trademark personal attacks that Trump frequently directs at his critics, but many Democrats in the chamber appeared unimpressed, jeering at several points. Mark Rozelle is the dean of the Scar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University in Virginia. He describes to me his reaction to the speech.
So the president called for unity, which I think is the right thing for him to have done in a State of the Union address, and I think that's sorely needed in the United States right now. But on the other hand, what people are going to be paying attention to is what he does as president, not what he says in one speech. So the rhetoric was fine. I think it was a nice departure from some of the rhetoric that's come out of the White House and from the president himself over the past year. But what really matters is whether he can sustain this message over time and do things in office that show that he actually means it.
Yeah, there has been some discussion about this sort of teleprompter Trump as opposed to Twitter Trump. You know, early in the morning, is his favorite time to tweet, and he's often very opinionated and sometimes he can be very critical. However, in this speech, it seemed as though he stayed pretty much on message, he stuck to the text.
Right. So the president showed that he can deliver very competently a formal address to the Congress and really to the country and the world, reading from a teleprompter, having had a team of speechwriters put together some very nice words, nice props there in the audience, right? There were some very good moments in the speech pointing to various heroes and their stories. But that's not the essence of the American presidency. The essence of the presidency is the ability to move forward policy objectives and to work with members of the legislative branch constructively, and that requires working with members of both parties. And that's the hard work to do, given the speech is easy. But the big disconnect that people are pointing to, of course, is that he speaks unity and bipartisanship as much as possible in the State of the Union address, but his Twitter account fires up in the morning. A lot of overheated comments about his opponents, about various folks in the news media, in the entertainment industry, and the like. And it's highly divisive stuff. So which is the real Donald Trump, many people ask.
Mr. Trump claimed credit for the good performance of the U.S. economy recently. Now, is that because of his performance in office, or does some of the credit belong to his predecessor, Barack Obama?
Right. It's both, no doubt about it. And I think any independent observer, economist would tell you that policies put in place by the previous administration are having a significant impact on the state of the economy today, and actions by the current administration are having an impact on the state of the U.S. economy today. So to say that we can untangle them completely and give all of the credit to one president or the other, I think is just highly misleading. And that's the kind of political rhetoric that we're seeing in Washington, D.C., where it's more important about who's right and who's wrong and who gets the credit and which party benefits. And I just don't think that's very healthy when we're looking at, for example, the economic data and trying to untangle which public policies are effective and which ones are not. So to be fair to Mr. Trump, all presidents do what he did last night. They all take credit for the good times when things are going well. That's the norm. So what he did is absolutely no different from what any of his predecessors have done during good economic times, and no one can blame him for that.
Mr. Trump also devoted a substantial part of the speech regarding foreign policy to North Korea. He, of course, has engaged in a sort of, you could say, war of words with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. But he made that the longest part of his speech in regard to North Korea as opposed to other international situations.
Right. And one can wonder why the president didn't have more to say about Russia, for example, about our relationship with China and the critical role there, particularly with regard to the problems in North Korea. And yet he made very critical comments early in the speech about those who oppose us, you know, specifying Russia and China. And there was much more he could have said about our interactions with our key allies around the world, you know, especially those in Europe, when many of our relationships right now with key allies are in tatters. But he didn't do that. He used the occasion to once again fire up the rhetoric about North Korea. And to be fair, that's something all Americans can agree on. And I think the president was touching on points where he knew there would be a positive response from the public. Nobody's going to defend North Korea. So he used the moment, I think, as another way of trying to unify the country, rally people around a common cause, and having something to be against is always the most effective in bringing people together.
Mark Rozell, Dean of the Scar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University. Time now for social media. Well, there's quite a lot of reaction to President Trump's State of the Union speech Tuesday night. Pollster Frank Luntz tweets, "Tonight I owe Donald Trump an apology. Tonight I was moved and inspired. Tonight I have hope and faith in America again. It may go away tomorrow, but tonight America is great again." However, Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren tweeted, "I went to the State of the Union. I wanted it burned into my eyes." She said, "If there's ever a moment when I'm too tired to keep fighting, I just have to close my eyes and see Donald Trump, Vice President Mike Pence, and Speaker of the House Paul Ryan applauding themselves for what she says, punching working families in the gut." And she said, "I'm back in this fight." Educating Liberals tweeted, "It was refreshing to see a few real heroes being honored last night instead of the self-pretentious idiots from Hollywood." Now This tweeted, "This is not who we are." Representative Joe Kennedy gave a passionate rebuttal of Trump's State of the Union speech. Mr. Kennedy was giving the Democratic response to President Trump's official State of the Union. Now also trending is hashtag social isolation. The American Association for Retired People tweets, "How bad is social isolation for one's health? As bad as smoking up to 15 cigarettes a day. That's over half a pack." Gene Akias, vice president of AARP, tweets, "Men are more likely to be socially isolated, according to AARP's policies groundmaking report." He says this has huge implications for the millions of male family caregivers. Jane Sarasone Khan tweets, "A huge milestone for healthcare that the World Health Organization has added social isolation to their list of social determinants of health." And that's a look at social media. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. The United Nations Children's Fund says conflicts and disasters contribute to the illiteracy of 59 million young people. The Vatican rebukes a Hong Kong cardinal over its outreach to China. A strong earthquake in Afghanistan kills at least one person in Pakistan. And the British Prime Minister Theresa May arrives in China to forge post-Brexit trade ties. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
French scientists say we humans as a species may have peaked and reached the maximum limits for height, lifespan, and physical performance. The researchers say their findings suggest humans have biological limitations that cannot be exceeded. Scientists say that despite increasing scientific, medical, and nutritional progress, these biological traits will no longer increase. Furthermore, the researchers also found that environmental changes caused by human activity, such as climate change, could have a harmful impact on these biological limitations. According to the researchers, signs that indicate we have reached the end of our biological limits will include fewer sports records being broken and that more people will not live beyond current life expectancy. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, the documentary Newspaper Man looks at the career of the former executive editor of The Washington Post, Ben Bradley. The head of UNRWA, the UN Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees, is sharply criticizing severe funding cuts by the United States. He warns the action could lead to rising instability in Palestinian territories and the region. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
UNRWA Commissioner General Pierre Kirchenbühl says the agency is facing the worst financial crisis in its history because of a U.S. decision to dramatically reduce its financial contributions.
Last year, the United States provided $360 million to UNRWA, and this year they've announced $60 million. That's the difference, right? So $300 million difference. We spend $1.2 to $1.3 billion a year, so that's a significant share of the income that we need.
U.S. President Donald Trump announced the cuts to UNRWA's budget after the U.N. General Assembly overwhelmingly voted to condemn his decision to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. Kirchenbühl tells VOA humanitarian funding should be related to the performance of an organization and not be linked with political considerations. He says the already explosive situation in Gaza will worsen if the funding shortfall remains and Palestinian needs go unmet.
It is clear that if that is not bridged, then there will be increased instability. With all of the other matters that the Middle East has to deal with in terms of insecurity, radicalization, and other concerns, I think, on the contrary, an investment in the stability of UNRWA's situation and our capacity to deliver services should be foremost on everyone's mind.
UNRWA has just launched an $800 million emergency appeal to assist Palestinian refugees in Gaza, the West Bank, and Syria. The money will provide desperately needed food, cash, emergency medical supplies, and support for mental health and gender-based violence programs. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
This is International Edition. A new documentary, The Newspaper Man, The Life and Times of Ben Bradley, takes an intimate journey through the life of the late Washington Post executive editor. Bradley is largely credited with taking down President Richard Nixon in 1974 after the Post broke the Watergate story, the largest political scandal in American history. Bradley also came to be known for ushering in a new era of investigative journalism, unafraid to take on the political establishment and a champion for the First Amendment, which is the right to free speech. International Edition's Lori London spoke with Sally Quinn, the widow of Ben Bradlee, who's a journalist herself. Lori asked Quinn about the timeliness of the film, coming as with the Trump administration, there's another president who has expressed his disdain for the news media.
They weren't planning to bring it out until the spring. And suddenly they thought, you know, this is really, and every day it became clearer and clearer, you know, with all of the, you know, the lying press and the dishonest media and the fake news and enemies of the people, that the First Amendment might actually be in jeopardy. And so they wanted to rush it out. And then, of course, there's the Tom Hanks Meryl Streep movie, and both of them did it on purpose because it is so relevant, because I think that all of us are scared. As Ben said, we're not out to be loved, but it's one thing to hate us, I mean personally, the media, but it's another thing to go up against the First Amendment. Ben was crazed on the subject of lying. He just couldn't stand it. You know, Trump is not subtle about his disdain and his contempt for the press. And when you start calling media enemies of the people, I mean, Ben fought in World War II. He was a patriot. He really loved this country. And I think that when people start calling the media enemies of the people, you're talking about people who literally are in a business that is supported by the Constitution. And if you go, if you're not in favor of the First Amendment, if you're not in favor of freedom of the press, then you basically don't believe in democracy, because you can't have democracy without freedom of the press. But journalists everywhere, I mean, in all news organizations, are just exhausted and strung out. And I don't like to sound dramatic or melodramatic, but it really is the future of the country that's at stake here.
The Washington Post, he played such an integral role there. You know, they've got a quote from him on the wall that I heard in the movie at the end. Someone said that this is Ben Bradlee's paper. It's still Ben Bradlee's paper. So how does it feel when you hear the president say it's fake news, calling the Post fake news? How do you feel, and what do you think Ben would say about it?
Well, I think, you know, Ben would, first of all, Ben would have been of two minds about this whole thing. He would have acknowledged that it was a great story, and it is a great story, and that would have gotten his juices flowing. But he would have been particularly made sure that we, and he was competitive, as I said, he would make sure that we had to get it right. But I think he would have been deeply disturbed and offended by the way that Trump and the people around him have portrayed the media. Nixon was smart, and you know from the tapes, and we played some of them in the film, where Nixon would say, you know, don't they have TV stations, and don't they have radio stations, and they're going to have a damnable time. But he didn't do a lot of that in public.
But it took a lot of courage for him to go up against a president.
Ben was the most fearless person I ever met in my entire life, and he trusted his gut. He trusted his instinct, and on both stories, it was his gut that made him say, but this isn't right. And the Pentagon Papers, the president had lied. The Secretary of Defense had lied about Vietnam. They had said and given speeches and statements that the war in Vietnam was a success. And when they knew that it was a failure, but they didn't want to lose the election, so they simply said it was a success, and thousands of U.S. GIs died because of it. That's an important story, and you know, you saw where people who were in the documentary, people saying, well, I trust Nixon, and I don't think the press is right, you know, he'll be proven right in the end. Well, the fact is, that was wrong. But as Ben said to Mike Wallace, if Nixon goes down, they're going to blame us. But the fact was that Ben, that was not what he was concerned about. He was concerned about getting the truth and getting the story and getting it right.
What would he have thought of the film?
I think he would have loved it. Ben was a sap, too. I mean, it's said in the film, he cried in movies. Mm-hmm. He cried in commercials. He probably would have cried.
What about you watching the story and hearing
his
voice?
It was hard. I've seen it three times. The first time I was sort of in shock. I just kind of, you know, just hearing his voice and all of that after been dead for 3 years now, and I was just kind of staggered out of there in shock. And then the second time I was really, really on the edge, and the third time I just completely lost it. I was sitting with my son Quinn in a screening in New York, and I just grabbed my hand and I just couldn't stop crying. It's a very emotional film, but it's also really interesting and entertaining and educational and and fun to watch. And you know, the genius of it was that they decided to use Ben's voice, because he had recorded his book. And so he narrates the film, so it makes it so much more accessible and more human, and so that you feel like Ben is sitting there in the room with you telling you his story.
Journalist Sally Quinn, she was speaking with International Edition's Lori London about the new documentary about the life of her late husband, Ben Bradley. Well, in this is breaking news, a train carrying several Republican lawmakers from Washington to a retreat in West Virginia was involved in an accident with a truck Wednesday in Southwest Virginia. There was no immediate word on how many people were injured. Congressman Bradley Byrne, a passenger on the train, posted on Twitter that he and his wife, Rebecca, were not injured. He tweets that security and doctors on board are helping secure the scene and treat injuries. Congressman Greg Walden also tweeted he was not injured and said emergency personnel are helping those who were on the truck. He said, "We're fine, but our train hit a garbage truck. Members with medical training are assisting the drivers of the truck." The crash occurred about 20 miles outside Charlottesville, Virginia. The lawmakers were en route to the Greenbrier Resort in the state of West Virginia to discuss how to sell their new tax law and how to repair the nation's crumbling infrastructure. President Donald Trump is scheduled to join the legislators on Thursday. And that is our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is committed to expanding its economic and cultural partnership with Iraq, said U.S. Deputy Secretary of State John Sullivan on a recent trip to Baghdad. The Deputy Secretary congratulated the Iraqi people and Iraqi security forces, many of whom lost their lives fighting ISIS and liberating their land. ISIS and its ideology remain the true enemies of Iraq, which is why the Iraqi people and the global coalition of 74 member nations will maintain their focus on eliminating this menace. Unity, stressed Deputy Secretary Sullivan, is Iraq's best weapon against ISIS and other extremist groups. He underscored the need for a continued dialogue between the government of Iraq and the Kurdistan Regional Government. The United States supports a federal, prosperous, unified, and democratic Iraq, one that meets the aspirations of all Iraqis. The United States is committed to assisting the victims of ISIS atrocities, to promoting religious freedom, and protecting religious diversity and pluralism. One example of this staunch commitment can be seen in the U.S.-funded partners who have removed more than 42,000 kilograms of explosive material from Anbar and Nineveh provinces. The U.S. has also provided more than $1.7 billion in humanitarian assistance since 2014, providing for the basic needs of Iraqis displaced from their homes by ISIS. This is in addition to the over $190 million in support for stabilization projects administered by United Nations Development Program, enabling more than 3 million Iraqis to return home. However, to safeguard an enduring stabilization across the country, Iraq must rebuild. The only way to attain lasting success is by encouraging private sector investment and growth. That is why the United States strongly supports the Reconstruction Conference that is being hosted in Kuwait in February. The U.S. also supports Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi's decision to hold elections on May 12th in accordance with Iraq's constitution. All Iraqis must know that the state that they have created and fought for will stand up for their rights, said Deputy Assistant Secretary Sullivan. Together, our governments and our people can overcome the challenges before us and secure a sovereign, stable, unified, and democratic Iraq that fosters the aspirations of all.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorial.